It's Saturday, May 22nd, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News, and in the second half, your questions and comments on technology. It's time now for Geek Speak.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
We're through with being cool. We're through with being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twists.
See, we know how to improvise. It can happen.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I am your host, Miles Elam. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. In the air room with me are Geek's Al Luckow, new media architect.
Hi, everybody.
Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy, and Command Tab Authority.
Authority. Good morning.
I'm an expert bookmarker. You didn't mention that.
And Lindsay Lonnie, system analyst.
That's me. Good morning.
If you could be a little bit louder.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah. Definitely hear you. You have such a great radio voice. Really love to hear you better.
Well, thank you.
So, let's get started with the news. Without further ado, Ben.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that today and tomorrow is the Maker Faire. It's in the Bay Area at the San Mateo Fairgrounds. And it's a really fantastic, let's see, it's an event that it was created by Make Magazine back in 2006. And the idea is a bunch of people who make really cool stuff come together in one place in a huge fairground and show it off. And that's it.
Colloquially known as makers.
Yes, exactly. So a bunch of makers come to the Maker Faire and a bunch of people come and look at their awesome stuff. And I'm going today. So I'm quite excited about that. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there. Any geeks would love this event. If you've never been, I'd highly recommend you go at some point, next year.
And it's not just technology geeks. You have a lot of stuff that's technology related. You have, you know, electronics, and you have, you know, the new technology in cars, but you also have
gearhead geeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or like people go and knit really cool things, you know, and they do things with cloth. There are 3D printers there. So there's a lot of technology stuff, but just really anyone who's a geek, and I at least define geek as someone who's really, really interested in any particular topic, like way more than most people.
They had a steam engine there.
They did, yeah. There's a big steampunk crowd there. So if you're into that, that's really cool, too.
My friend had a thing called a... My friend Bruce did this thing called a dump tank. It was made out of a toilet basin. And it was like one of those things you throw and you hit something and it pours water on your head. So you're going to see all sorts of weird stuff there.
Yeah, one of my favorite exhibits or installations last year is you stand on this platform. It's outside on this. There's this huge concrete area, and all of these things are set up outside, a lot of them involving fire and things that you can't do inside.
And metallic sculpture.
And metallic, yeah, really cool. So also a lot of stuff that you see at Burning Man, you also see at Maker Faire.
So where's it being held?
It's San Mateo Fairground. But one of my favorite installations was you stand on this platform in the center, and they've got a bunch of sensors in a ring around you pointing just up. And so you can put your hand out, and it'll detect that your hand is pointing in a specific direction, or your foot, and it'll make flame spurt out of the ground in the direction that you're pointing. So you can, you know, spin around and flame will follow you. You just feel like some kind of god. It's incredible. So anyway, cool, very
giant
cool stuff
Tesla
at Maker
coil.
Faire. And I think also they put it on in Austin, Texas, but I'm not sure if they still do or when they do. But I do know this year at San Mateo Fairgrounds.
So. Is it more ostentatious in Austin, Texas?
I'm not witty enough to respond to that. You're too fast.
So, Al, you're up.
Sure. Well, this has to be one of the coolest products I've seen in a long time. A company in the Netherlands called Creolev has created a whole company focused on making levitation products.
Levitation
products.
But for real, not like a magician?
Yep, levitating. They call them levitation modules. The largest one can carry a 10-kilogram payload. Mostly of what they seem to be doing are in-store displays. But you know, this is only the beginning. From what I can tell from the website, it looks like the device comes in two pieces. They look like metal discs, kind of like they look like those big things you put on your weight set, your barbells, you know, the plates. It just looks like two plates. Of course, they don't weigh as much as a barbell, but they look like those things. And it looks like so far they have one real consumer product in the works. It's a floating clock called the Emit. It's really neat to look at the web. After the show, check out the show notes. Everything that they're making, and this is in the Netherlands, and it's this big building in the Netherlands, and they have all these like creative companies in this one giant building. It's just kind of cool. It sort of reminds me of, you know, some places in San Francisco are like this. But everything they have, it's just, you know, you put the base down, and then you put this other thing in the object, and it just levitates, and you can put your hand underneath it, and, you know, as far as I can tell, it's probably like a magnetic thing.
Yeah, I've seen stuff like that with regard to superconducting.
Yeah.
Or rather, yeah, superconducting platforms with a natural magnet on it. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. at the same time, you're talking about stuff that's
it's like floating. Like they have
general room temperature.
Right.
Consumer.
One of their things they have is this sort of like the upper torso of a human. And you can put a shirt on it. And it goes in the store display or whatever. And then
mannequin
it turns.
Thing.
Yeah, it's like a mannequin. And then it turns. So you have this like floating shirt that's literally not connected to anything. And it's turning. So you can control motion and it's floating.
There was this toy. I can't remember what it's called. But it was a little spinning top. You spin mm-hmm. it really, really fast. And then you lift up the little thing and it starts hovering. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly – I have no idea how this would work, though. I mean, I wonder if it's a rotating magnet kind of thing where, you know, you don't have it wanting to spin over because of gyroscopic forces.
Well,
but that's not spinning too fast, it looks like.
It's definitely plugged in. And, you know, just – it's a company that makes floating things. I mean, come
fair
on.
Enough,
this is,
fair enough.
This is cool. This is a really cool thing, you know.
All right. Thank you for that news story. Lindsay.
Okay, so more Google goodies. The Federal Trade Commission yesterday approved Google's $750 million acquisition of AdMob. So there was about 6 months of feet dragging on that.
What is AdMob?
It's just an advertisement engine that was somewhat, I believe, of a competitor.
To Google AdWords, right?
Right, to Google AdWords.
And actually, Apple was after AdMob.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They were trying to buy AdMob at the same time, and Google just outbid or outdid them or somehow
swooped
got them.
Down in yeah. the middle of the...
and Apple ended up buying some smaller company, but I forgot what the name of it was.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's basically that Apple saved them from having the FTC say no for monopoly reasons. Because
exactly.
then Apple came up and bought this other small company, and so now they actually have competition. So Apple's starting its own ad program.
Like, does Google really need to be buying up more ad companies to make money? Yeah.
Yeah, but it's interesting that the reason that they got it approved was because Apple bought the other company. Because
Quattro,
that's what it is, yeah. And if Apple hadn't bought that, then Google wouldn't have been able to have their acquisition approved. And then it's like you're competing, but you did this thing that like kind of...
helps each other, yeah.
So did Apple buy Quattro to run the engine behind their iAd
yes.
campaign?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
That's what it is.
So the iAd campaign being what they have on all their iPhones and iPads mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. their ad environment?
It's the new thing.
Okay, so...
the new big thing.
You got two juggernauts battling it out for who gets everybody's eye space.
Okay. Yeah. It's a very interesting dance to watch between Apple and Google.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Strike, counter-strike is what, kind of what it feels like. And then, you know, Adobe's it's randomly just, there.
Speaking,
yeah. It's just interesting, though, if Apple hadn't done that, Google wouldn't have been able to do it.
Mm-hmm. Or they would have been sued to oblivion.
Right. So,
and people would be saying things that a lot of people are saying about Apple, about anti-monopolistic thing, also about Google, and that would have been, well, anyway.
Yeah, it's a weird, weird world we live in.
Yes, what a tangled web we weave.
Yeah.
But speaking of Google, Ben.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Google. So Google recently had their developers conference, and that was just this last week, called Google I/O, I/O standing for input-output. And they have a lot.
Similar to the local cruise I.O.
So they had a lot of really interesting announcements. I'm very excited to see where all of these things go.
Get to the good part.
One of the things they announced is Google Android 2.2, which is their new Android OS. And that is going to be actually one of the really cool things that I was really happy about. I have a Nexus One I bought just this year. And
the Google phone,
yes.
That they just discontinued, by the way.
Did they what?
Yeah.
They just discontinued. They're not selling it directly anymore.
They decided.
Google is not selling it directly
In the U.S. anyway.
Yeah, they decided.
Nah. Wait, so the Nexus One is not being sold?
No.
Right.
Interesting.
At least not in the general market. Mm-hmm.
So you can buy one on eBay, but you couldn't buy
They're still making them, but they're not for general public consumption.
I think I saw one at a garage sale.
Okay, that's just me.
Oh, man. Okay, well, anyway, it's not dead because the 2010 handsets made by HTC will get an over-the-air update to Android 2.2, which is kind of cool for me, at least. They also have a new open-source standard for video compression, also kind of a not-so-subtle jab at Apple because Apple didn't implement Flash, and so you know they're kind of looking for different ways to deliver video to mobile devices, and so Google open sourced their VP video codec, which is based on based on Og Vorbis. Is that
It's VP8 is the name of the codec. It's based upon VP2, which is what Og Fiora was based on.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
They are using Og Vorbis.
So
as
tell everybody
an audio layer.
What Og right. is, just so they know.
Og is made by a company called XIPH. XIPH. So if I'm pronouncing that wrong, you know, sorry, it's spelled XIPH. What are you supposed to do? And one of their goals is making codecs. In other words, whenever you're looking at video or audio, it has to be digitized in some way, and that's done by a codec. And the better the codec, the better it sounds, the better it looks.
Like an example would be MP3, for example.
Right, is an example of a codec.
Yeah.
And Og is one of these codecs.
MPEG-2 is an example of a codec that's used for DVDs as opposed to H.264, which is the codec used for Blu-ray.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And also a lot of the video that you see online is H.264.
It gets complicated.
Yeah, but there are all these issues with who pays who when whoever uses this codec and whatnot, because this person developed this codec or this company.
Right, so the big deal about Og, Og Vorbis, Og Theora, the audio and video codecs respectively, are that they do not have any patents that are being enforced on the general public. They're royalty and patent free.
So you can get this. You can encode your audio and video with Og, or was it just as far as I remembered, Og was sort of like.
Og-Theora uses Og Vorbis as an audio layer.
Oh. So you have this really good.
And so does VP8.
And it's
calling it WebM.
It's considered a really good compression.
It's definitely better than MP3.
Well, everything that's out there today is, amazingly better than it was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like it's really hard to even compare them. You have them side by side and you can go like, oh yeah, it's obvious that even the worst codec today is better than the best one 10 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Not just in quality, but also in size.
Right.
Which is great for mobile devices. Like MP3 versus something like, Apple lossless, which is oftentimes a similar quality, but it's lossless instead of lossy. You don't lose data.
So you don't. It's okay, high quality.
Yeah, it seems like we're going onto a whole.
We've gone down the rabbit hole.
Definitely are going down the rabbit hole, leaving our audience behind to stare down that black pit where we've fallen.
Yeah, this is regular for I guess us after the show.
So let's move on.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. I actually have.
Wait. First, I have to do the big booming voice. Al, please tell us about what your next stories are going to be.
Ooh, I have shivers.
I'm playing God here.
Playing God. All right. Well, it turns out that we have actually created life. There's been an artificial life breakthrough. And this is because...
Someone gave birth?
Artificial life.
So. Yes, artificial life. And they've just announced this. It was in Science Magazine. This guy, Dr. Craig Venter... He has succeeded in transplanting synthetic DNA for a bacterium into a host cell. So what that really means is that they've created a synthetic living cell. Oh, and they've named the cell. It's called Cynthia, which, you know, using the word synthetic, they kind of, if you can imagine how that's spelled. So now they're, this guy, Dr. Craig Mentner, has created life, and it also brings out all these things about playing God, and, you know, how are people going to deal with this, and what if this thing gets out in the open, and all that kind of stuff. So there's a huge debate going on now about the ethics of this. But this guy, when I was looking about this, really interesting, you know, guy created life, and that's cool and all that and weird. But then I started looking at the guy, Dr. Craig Mentner, and he actually is sort of like a maverick in the field. He's like one of the guys that did the genome project with frog, and he's just one of those like superstar scientists, mm-hmm. who just and he had a bunch of huge successes with he's also kind of full of himself, but he's had a bunch of huge successes with the human genome. He's really kind of been at the forefront of that, but it's made him pretty wealthy. So he's like this really rich guy, flies around in Learjets and everything.
Well, I just want to say before you go on that, mm-hmm. I for one welcome our artificial lab-grown life form overlords.
Right. I guess so. This could have been a robot story, but this guy, he just is one of those people. He just, you know, puts all this money. He doesn't need money anymore. He doesn't have to. He's not forced to do things because of some bureaucracy that says, "Oh, we're only going to give you money if you do something that's related to, you know, DuPont or something." You know, he's doing things that he wants to do, and whether or not you agree with them is one thing. But it's interesting to note that the things that he does aren't based on corporate direction. He's just doing it out of his own, you know, from his own wealth. And this particular thing is one of those things that he's just created, this synthetic cell.
But it also means that another door has opened, that if we haven't thought about it already, we need to seriously start thinking about it. This is the realm of science fiction now becomes science fact.
Right.
So that question of what happens the next time someone says, hey, I want to engineer a virus from scratch, or what happens if you get past the single-celled organism, you start getting to multicellular, and how far do you know, what are the ethical questions to that, if
yeah.
any?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, he's certainly creating a lot of controversy. But even doing the human genome was it was competitive and very, very ethically. You know, what are we doing here? You know, mm-hmm. So I'd look for more from this guy, and it's interesting what he's done, but it's also interesting to see who he is and what else he's going to do. Mm-hmm. Because he's just not, you know, most of these scientific big achievements, they're all backed by corporate grants and things. And, you know, you wonder, oh, they've just discovered this great thing, but funny how it benefits, you know, Coca-Cola or something, you know?
Yeah, and it is useful to note that scientific discovery and scientific achievement, they're kind of like a genie coming out of the bottle. You can't put it back into mm-hmm. the lamp.
Exactly.
But you can decide how you're going to use that technology. So I invite people not to say like, oh, we're going to protest this and make sure it doesn't happen. It's going to happen. If this guy didn't do it, someone else is going to. So how are we going to make our world better, not worse, mm-hmm. through it?
Right.
And one of the things that I remembered reading in that article was talking about possibilities for generating life forms that create fuels, for example. Mm-hmm. And generating life forms whose sole purpose in life is to generate, you know, meat products so you're not hurting animals.
Right.
You know, that type of thing.
Right.
So there is potential. I mean, yeah, it's an amazing achievement.
Yeah, I mean, I would encourage people to check out these links after the show and learn about this guy, because for whether he's good or evil, he's an interesting guy. And I think, you know, that's the reason that you're seeing things like this, is because of this guy. Is just, he's just, you know, doing what he wants.
So, all right. Thank you for that story. Lindsay.
Okay, well, do you ever just wake up in the morning wishing that there was a 3-terabyte hard drive on the market?
I do all the time.
I wake up in cold sweat.
Pretty much. I always check the Fry's ads every morning to see if there's a 3-terabyte.
Well, guess what? Seagate did it. Seagate's got 3-terabyte drive from Seagate. It's
they've
not out
it
yet.
They've announced it.
It's not out yet. They've announced it. But here's the caveats that come along with it. You have to have a 64-bit Win7 or Vista or Linux versions that can support it, and only as an external drive, because BIOS can't support it.
Or rather, unless you have an EFI BIOS.
Exactly.
You can't do it. Okay.
So, yeah, that's the caveats. They say that they've tested with XP and stuff like that, but it only detects 990 megs of the total.
Which is not very much of the total.
That's awful.
Yeah, so I'm excited about that.
Right, so the way they're, I'm assuming, doing this is not only the platter density going up, but putting in multiple platters. So they have, I think, probably four platters in there working, so a lot of moving parts.
The stuff I read didn't disclose exactly how they did it under the covers, which I'm curious about, but I'm assuming it's something like that.
And they're also moving, just like Western Digital, they're moving toward the 4K sector size, up from the 512-byte sector size.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is one of the primary reasons that it's not working with XP all that well.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So you should be able to use it on any file system that supports those sizes, right?
Not actually, just modern NTFS. Operating systems use a 4 kilobyte page for virtual memory.
Even like HFS Plus on OS X?
I believe so.
Really?
Most modern operating systems don't use a 512 kilobyte page anymore because it's not as efficient. The problem with it, though, is that with 512 bytes, they fit evenly into that 4-byte structure or 4-kilobyte structure. The 4-kilobyte sector on a hard drive would also fit perfectly and actually has some performance advantages as well as space advantages. But if you get the alignment off so that the 4-kilobyte doesn't start at the beginning of the 4-kilobyte page, you end up having to read 8 kilobytes to get that 4 kilobytes. Mm.
So that's not a help. But the cool thing about this drive that Lindsay mentioned, though, is that it's a single drive.
Yeah.
Because there are there's more multi-terabyte local area network storage systems. You can buy a system and have like 6 terabytes in there. But what she's saying is it's a single drive that holds 3
Yeah,
terabytes.
We're definitely increasing our ability to lose all the data we have ever owned in a single stroke.
Yeah. Yeah.
I actually, it was very startling. I was looking at all the hard drives. I'm cleaning my room and all of my worldly possessions and getting rid of a bunch of stuff. And I found that I totaled it all up. I actually have 9 terabytes of hard drive space, all working hard drives. That's really scary to me, like to have that much capacity.
Yeah, I definitely have less than that. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Geek Speak on KUSP, supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. I invite you to call in to the show. It is a call-in show, after all. And the numbers are 476-2800, or call toll-free in the state of California, 1-800-655-5877. So at this point, we have a thing called a geek bit, which can either be some little recording, or in this case, a mobile app of the week. And it turns out both Al and Ben have one of those. So Al, you want to start off with your iPhone?
Yeah, the one that I think is pretty neat is called Moe's Notes. And you can find it in the App Store just by typing in Moe's Notes. This thing, it's a multimedia note recorder, and it records things like it'll record a picture and sound, and you save it as like a note. And I found it to be really cool. It you can capture, audio, visual, textural ideas, and just. It thinks more like you do visually and just records all these different things. You can record the geolocation data of what's going on right around your area, and then you can send this to somebody. You can save it as your own organizational note, or you can send it to somebody as an email. So, like, I was outside, and my little girl was playing in the yard in the sprinkler, and so I decided that I would take a picture, which I did. And then I hit the little record button, and I recorded her, giggling and laughing. And then I touched the little tab that said that let me write a little note, and I said, this is, playing in the sprinkler. And then I tagged it as, family, child, that kind of stuff. And then I emailed it to my mom. So, and it all comes out of one little app. And you'd think, these are all things that we understand, but Moe's Notes has kind of put it into one little thing. And it's just sort of a neat thing to just be able to capture moments and just, you know, save them. If you had notes or whatever like that, I could do one for the show right now. You know, of course, if I did one about Moe's notes, that would be, it would create an endless loop.
Yeah, and strange infinite recursion could, is the world a dangerous could end. Thing.
Yeah.
But Hofstetter would pop out of your iPhone.
But I found it strangely compelling. And it also does a stamp with your geolocation data as well. So, you know, that's my app.
Awesome.
And mine's a quick mention. It's a free app called NetaShare.
Wait, free app for?
Android, I'm sorry. Yeah, so he has the iPhone, I have the Android phone, so we figure we'll do both. It's called NetaShare, and it synchronizes with your Google Reader. And this is very useful to me because that's pretty much where I get all of my geek news and where I star the ones that I like. One of the coolest things about it, though, is that it will actually sync and go offline. So I can be on the Caltrain or something like that, or maybe actually in a tunnel, let's say an Oakland tunnel on the BART, and I can still read all of these things. And it doesn't just synchronize the headlines like a lot of these reader synchronization apps. It actually synchronizes the text of the page, not the images. So it's not a huge bandwidth hog, but it's a really fantastic way to keep track of the news around you.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Who wants the next news story? Because I realized that I just gave two new segments. Lindsay, do you have something squared away? Okay, so we'll go back to Ben.
Okay, so I have a little bit more about Google, just because Google I.O. was so very dense. So I'm going to talk a bit about Google.
Oh, actually, sorry. Before we start up, I want to announce that, yes, we are a call-in show. If you have any questions about Windows, Linux, OS X, just about anything. Actually, any technology-related question, you can ask us. We do not give any guarantees that we will be correct and be helpful, but we will at least try to be entertaining in our wrongness. So please call up. The numbers are area code 831-476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Okay, Ben, sorry for the interruption. Google.
No worries. I just got derailed. No, not quite. So Google has also been doing some interesting things with media that were just announced on at Google I.O. One of them is the Android Market, which previously has been an application store for your mobile devices. So that's kind of like the iPhone App Store. It's called the Android Market. Well, it turns out it's now going to be also a music store. And the huge advantage with this is that all of your music gets synced not just to your computer, but also to your phone. And you don't have to connect your phone to your computer directly.
They're trying to take on iTunes on all levels.
Exactly, they are. They're trying to kind of take on iTunes and remove the necessity and the hassle of having to physically connect your mobile device to your less mobile device.
Well, not only that, they actually, another thing that they just did was the App Store. They just opened up an App Store in the Chrome browser.
So, that's true too.
So you can buy, this has just been announced last week, you can buy applications that run within your browser through the Google Chrome App Store. So you're actually buying like an online app.
Right. So how is that different? For example, I've seen on their App Store they have like icons for Gmail and things like that.
Well, you're saying apps on their phone. I'm saying apps
for
the browser.
I get that. What I'm wondering is how is that different from putting in a URL? Let's say I'm a web developer and they're saying Chrome App Store. Why don't I just make a web page and have people go to the web page?
Because because Google is handling the transaction, so they're going to be giving the developer money based on the purchase of, so say you made,
so it's about monetizing.
Yeah, say you made an application that does like allows you to, you know, put mustaches on people or something, and it all happens within the browser. So you only need to have the Google Chrome browser. As far as I know, this is sort of focusing on HTML5, five apps or something like that. So
not Flash.
No, it's definitely not they don't specifically say they don't do Flash, but they're focusing on the power of HTML5 as a programming language. So that's why they're doing this. And so you can go to this page, look at a number of apps, like the one that puts mustaches on people, and say, oh, I wouldn't mind having that app. Well, it's a dollar. So you can buy the app right there in the browser, and then you own the app. And what they're saying It says, and I quote, Google has a plan to provide developers with 70% of the revenue from the application. So you can have free apps in there too, but they're giving the developer 70% of the cost. So if it's a dollar, then the developer gets 70 cents.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't find it nearly as compelling as mobile apps, just mainly because there are so many websites to do all of these different things mm-hmm. that are just that they're just there. And
oh,
they're
certainly.
Just free.
There's yep. nothing. You're absolutely right. You can just go to a URL. But like I said, the thing is, you can sell through the App Store.
Yeah, it's a lot harder to put up a website where you make money, where you mm-hmm. have to put in your own infrastructure.
Right. So they're providing the channel. I could have the best thing in the world that I want to sell, but if I don't have a channel to sell it in, and if I don't have any store to put it in, then it doesn't really help anybody. But now you've got Google and Google Apps, so people will go to this place looking for stuff and where they might purchase it, and then Google will handle the whole transaction, and I'll get my 70 cents for my dollar application, and it's just sort of a no-brainer. So you can make, I think it's a potential for a lot of junk apps, if you ask me, but it's also potential for people making a lot of money.
Yeah, it does put into perspective the idea of Apple saying we're going to be a gatekeeper so that everyone can flood mm-hmm. what Google do about that, since they've always historically been reluctant to do so, to put any restrictions on it.
Yeah.
But so this segment's run pretty long, but just to finish what I was saying, there's the market, which is going to be the music store, and they've also introduced Google TV, which presumably will be a direct competitor with Apple TV. It looks really, really very cool. I'm not going to cover it really in depth or anything, but go ahead and take a look at their website. They have a lot of cool things coming out. And not just the things that they've announced, but I'm sure there's quite a bit to come as far as where they're going with it. So.
Okay. Well, thank you for that story, Ben. And let's take a call. So we have Jackie from San Martin. Hello? And apparently not coming in. Let's see here.
Just a hum.
Unless they're humming, because I
Hello,
can
Jackie?
Hear that perfect.
Nope. Up. Oh.
I recognize that sound.
Yep, I appear to have lost Jackie. But at least I figured out the board as opposed to having
Rick said try again.
Rick said try again.
Yeah, Rick, our gatekeeper for the phones.
Yeah. Rick Philman.
No.
Yeah, the busy signal's still there.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll move on to other news while we work out our technical difficulties. So, Al, you're up.
Well, as long as we – turns out we're talking about Google so much today. there is an interesting thing now that Google's providing. It's called the secure search. So, when you search in Google, it's not really a private thing. People can find out all the things you searched for. I've mentioned stories in the past where, some guy got in an accident and as a hit and run, and he got home and he started searching on his computer for places that he could get his car fixed and hit and run laws and all this kind of stuff. And when the police sort of suspected him, they found his computer and they were able to see all the things that he searched for and thereby kind of incriminated himself by that. Now, that's a good use of being able to know. But I think that's probably not the main thing. I mean, people mm-hmm. just don't want to know, they don't want everybody to know what they're searching for. So Google is offering now. They've just announced it's called an encrypted search. And that means that your ISP and the people on your network won't be able to see what you're searching for.
Oh, so it's not Google not being able to know what you're searching about. It's about
other people not being able to see.
Google will certainly know what you're searching about, no matter what. So just give up and say, well, Google is basically going to know everything about you and there's nothing you can do about it. So
if you use the Google search.
If you're going to use Google. So just admit that right away. But nobody else will know, and I'm posting a link in our show notes for the actual Google encrypted search. It's actually still google.com, but I think it's HTTPS or something. It's in there, and when you go there, it's an encrypted search, so you can be searching for all the stuff that you don't want everybody to know you're searching for, and it looks just like the regular Google search engine. There's nothing different. It's just
so useful if you're in a airport or someplace a coffee shop where they're not doing any type of.
Or you're just somebody who's concerned with their privacy and does everything that they can to prevent you know, people from finding stuff out about you. So,
well, then I'd question whether or not you should use Google. But
yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly. I mean,
everything's a give and take there.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we've got on line two Jackie from San Martin.
Oh, yeah, hi. I'll see if this works. And our phones are really bad out here. Anyway, so when you download pictures off a digital camera, they get saved as these massive JPEGs. I don't want to have to use Outlook to convert it in order to email it. What can I do in the Windows environment to make that file size more manageable to email?
Right, so you're going to be changing the resolution on that image. Mm-hmm. Right now it's probably ending up being, what is the default for a lot of cameras, like 2,000 by?
It's 24-something, 36 okay. by 24-something.
Well, the quickest way would be to choose low resolution for your photos when you take them, but nobody wants to have a bunch of low resolution photos in case you want to print them later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One option, I'm not sure for Windows because I don't use Windows much, but I do know that there are several websites out there which will let you upload your large files, and they'll give you a smaller file.
But then you have to upload them. I mean, one of the issues is that you have to upload this image up to a website.
Well,
and
my issue with sending email photos is just that you're sending over 10 megs through email. It bogs down everyone's mail client. Not so much the fact that you have to upload the pictures.
Right.
Now,
right. Most people's internet connections are asymmetric, meaning that you may get 5 megabits per second downstream or 6 megabits per second downstream, but your upstream is only going to be 1.
That is true. I don't know of any batch compressors on the PC, but there are some online. If you search for there's one, jpegoptimizer.com is one of them. So I don't know, you can do a Google search
but
and find those.
If you don't mind, you know, buying something that's just really reasonably priced, there is one called iBatch from Atlasoft. And what it's called is batch processing software, and it will take a folder filled with JPEGs, and just you say, okay, change these to all of these, you know, to low res, and it'll just do it. And it's a Windows program. I'm posting the link right now. After the show, these will be live, and you can go and check it out. And this is just, I mean, there are probably, man, there's probably hundreds of these things. But this one is just under $25. So it's an application, and it'll be, you know, it'll be exactly what you want.
But and you may also be able to find free ones out there too.
Picasso will do it.
Picasso client from Google.
Yeah, it's free.
But you have to, is that something you have to do online, or can you just?
You can either download the free software. Actually, you would have to download the free software to your machine and install it. And then you can just
I just haven't ever tried it yet. So.
One advantage
of easy solution. Once again, we're plugging Google again. Turning into an ad.
Or Picasso, or there's another one that's, I'm forgetting the name of it. There's another.
Right, the ones that I'm thinking of end up being far too complex, like the GIMP. That's far too much effort and complexity for that. So I think the
however,
Picasso
it is free.
Really, I think Picasso is a really good example.
It's a good way to do it in a batch. Some native Windows image stuff, you can go into the properties of the image and basically just decrease the size of the image, and that'll do it. But it's a pain.
I was wondering about that.
You have to do it one by one. So Picasso's much easier if you have a group of images.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's what I'd like to do. And I don't know what Outlook does, but then I have to bring up Outlook, and then what happens is I have to, you know, go through Outlook, which goes back through my regular browser, and it's just really, it's just kind of a pain, especially, you know, 11 o'clock at night, you just want to send a couple quick pictures to somebody.
Right, and Outlook isn't always smart about it. It may go like, "Oh, you want to send this big, you want to send this huge image?" Well, okay.
And so sometimes
it's easy to mess up with that.
I mean, if you're going to use Picasa, you know, you can get that. I just posted the link that will be up after the show too. Well, it may make sense to go ahead and get a Picasa album as well and just kind of store your photos there. And then when you send an email to somebody, you can send them a link to the picture rather than the picture itself. So the email is a lot smaller. And that way, you know, they're just seeing the link. They click on it. And then the picture can be a little bit bigger because it's in a browser and people understand, you know, they don't have to wait for things. You know, when a picture shows in a browser, it's usually pretty efficient.
Yeah, especially useful for if you have multiple recipients.
And then they can download from that.
Oh, yeah. You can, most browsers, any picture, I don't know if people realize this, you can just click on it and drag it to your desktop or right-click on it and save as, and you can get that picture. which or a screen grab. Okay. There's multiple ways to get pictures off of web pages.
All right. So thank you for the call, Jackie.
Yeah, I'm going to give that a try.
All right. Great.
All right. Hey, I liked your improvised music this morning.
Thank you.
Yes.
Glad someone did.
I was waiting for that. I was like, where's the music? Where's the music?
Yeah, we're working on our barbershop
All
quartet.
Right.
So. Yeah.
Hey, have a good day.
All right, take care. And on line three, we've got Christo from Monterey.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Well, I have a question about something I'm hearing, kind of a rumor about, but I'm hearing it from more than one or two people. Some of them are the people that sold me my computer. I bought an iMac, an i7 4 core, which is a really nice computer.
Mm-hmm. But, one of the new ones, yeah.
I was going to buy an iPad, you know, to kind of go with it and use the iPad more for, like, watching, you know, demonstrations of how to use the software that I bought for the computer and stuff like that. But I also heard that from my computer, I could leave my iMac at home in the near future, and that with, I'm not sure if it's the next generation of iPad, but with an upcoming version of the iPad, actually be able to send the data that's sequencing in my DAW over the air, like a telephone almost, but at, you know, at 96 dB, and take the iPad to a gig instead of my computer with all my really expensive plugins and software in it, and take the iPad to the gig and receive the song data through the iPad over some kind, I don't know if it's Skype that they're talking about transmitting it over or whatever, but I was wondering if you guys had heard about something like that, because they're also saying that on top of that, with the iPad and the gesturing technology, I'll actually be able to edit within my DAW remotely back at home.
So you're in a band, and
well,
you...
it's not really a band. It's okay. Kind of like Kraftwerk. It's kind of like, you know, we stand in front of computers and make sounds.
Well, that's it. You know, I mean, this is liberal use of the band, but so you're in a band and you have some software that runs on your Mac, and you want to go to your gig and be able to manipulate the software via your iPad.
Correct.
So
kind of like, well, yeah, stream the audio possible, to the gig and, like, you know, use the iPad, plug it into the port. Now all of a sudden I don't have to take my computer to a place where beer or cigarettes may be spilled on it.
Yeah, the technology is called VNC, which is using a remote device, be it another laptop, another computer or something, to control another one. And a lot of times...
Well, it's actually a combination. It's VNC and, plus an audio stream.
Yeah, plus an audio stream. Yeah, so the technology is all definitely there. I haven't heard anything about that coming out, and also, you know, just have to be careful what rumors you do believe and what rumors you don't believe, and don't, like, make choices based on just hearsay or rumors.
You'd have to be absolutely sure that you had a good connection to the internet.
Yeah, that's true. There would also be latency issues where, like, you know, you make a sound and then it takes a second to transmit that audio, and so you have a delay. If you ever tried harmonizing or playing music with someone over Skype, you've experienced that before.
It's really, you know, the technology is there, and you could certainly do this from a laptop. You know, if you have Macs, there's an application called Back to Your Mac where you can actually just access your Mac. The iPad is built upon the foundation of cloud computing, which is exactly what you're describing. Is basically, you're talking about your iMac, but you might have your application within the cloud. And then you'd use the cloud. You know, that's totally what the iPad is designed around. I wouldn't put all your hopes into having something that's really usable right away. Mm-hmm. But the whole idea of what you're saying, oh yeah, that's exactly what that's exactly where everything is moving. I don't know that I would buy the iPad specifically to do that yet. But it's certainly.
Do you think the latency issue will be addressed to the point where we're no longer discussing latency at some point?
Well, that's
it seems
not
to me that is the central biggest problem with all of it, you know? I mean, whether you're recording an audio track or you're recording, you know, or like we're talking about streaming something over Skype to have a delay is kind of, you know.
But that's not a function of the hardware on either end. That's a function of the network infrastructure in the United States. So, you know, maybe if that gets bumped up, I mean, also it's a function of distance, right? How far does the signal have to transfer? I mean, even over the phone, you do have some latency issues. So
yeah. Well, I just think that would be the greatest that would change everything for you that are doing electronic
music. You know, there's a lot of cool browser apps. I think we talked about one a while back. I forget what it is, but you can actually design music within the browser and save your file, and that would be a way that you could use. I don't know if it uses Flash or not. I can't recall. But
what application would that be?
Yeah, now I got to remember what this is. But yeah. it's pretty cool because you're able to save. It's sort of like a MIDI sequence, and then you have like just like an account, and that you just access your MIDI sequences and then you play them.
Wow.
You might, I'll take a look and I'll post it in the show notes and see if I can find that for you. Okay.
Well, you guys did a really great job of answering that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call.
No worries. Peace.
Take care. Wow, we took two calls and we actually had something useful to say.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's a cool thing, being able to – I can see people wanting to do that because, I have a really big computers at home, you know.
Yeah, I can't help but think that in, you know, 2 or 3 years' time that the iPad 7G will come out and it will have a DAW interface – on the pad itself that you work with, and then you play the songs, and that the storage will be enough that you can handle most sound effects.
You know,
we'll be having like 500 gig SSDs
in a small way.
Tablets.
I'm actually doing this now because it used to be that I would put some notes for the stories and stuff that I had in a show, and I put them in a little text file, and I'd do them on my computer at home while I was looking stuff and stick URLs in and all that kind of stuff. I put them on a USB thing. And then I would take my laptop, and I would bring my laptop to the show here, and I'd stick the USB thing, and I'd have all my stuff with me, and I'd have to, you know, I'd be manipulating all this stuff. But recently, I just started using MobileMe. I've had MobileMe, which is the online
Apple
storage.
Apple subscription.
Yeah, it's like $99 a year or something. And basically, they give you this drive that's virtually available. So when I turn my computer on, whether it's my laptop or my desktop, I see this little folder and I double click on it and it looks like it's on my drive, but it's really in the cloud. So I save my notes to that thing. And I also save, you know, whenever I have a recording or crazy USB or something, I'll put them in there. And so they're just virtually available. And now I've just started working on them from there. So I don't even drag it to my drive. The file always stays in this cloud area. And I just open it from there and it's open on my computer, but it's saving back to this place. So I never even worry about bringing it with me because it's always like there. And so it's essentially the same thing that this guy was talking about. Is he wants to be able to work on his music in one place like that. But, of course, that requires the application.
That's not streaming, though. That's not streaming.
It's
that's
not
just
really streaming,
that's just having a storage that's up on the cloud that you can access as if it's local.
Right.
But it's still moving it to a place and then moving it from that place. It's not
But it's also the idea of taking a $500 device to your gig as to play music and deal with that stuff as opposed to taking your $3,000 quad core.
Right.
Sure. Yeah. But that's still, again, for static files. It wouldn't be for collaboration. One thing I wanted to Dropbox will do a very similar thing.
Oh, yeah. Same thing, yeah.
Yeah, it's slightly different because it's actually something that's on your local computer, and then it just syncs, but it syncs really, really, really well.
Yeah, Dropbox
is... And it's free.
Yeah, you should tell
them
what that
is. It's free for like 2 gigs of storage. But anyway, I did want to mention, we had Rogue Amoeba on the show, I think, a couple months ago, and they have a product which does streaming, but the biggest problem that I have with it is that it's not real-time streaming, because there still is time that the computer needs to compress the audio stream down so it can send it efficiently without having hiccups and
right.
You know, things like that.
When they send it to AirTunes, AirTunes has a 2 second buffer.
Yeah. Or more, actually. It's not necessarily exactly 2 seconds as well, because I was streaming to different computers within my house music, and the music was clashing a little bit because they were a little bit off. So that's another one of the issues. It's not just the latency, but also compressing the audio stream before sending it off next time.
Quick mention, this coming from Alex, our Southern California correspondent. He's berating us for forgetting, when we talked about Pac-Man on the Google browser, to mention the reason why Google did this is because yesterday was the 30th birthday of Pac-Man.
Happy birthday.
Did everyone waste time on that game yesterday?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is yet another thing that's older than Ben.
Oh, jeez. Have we started? Let's just have a whole segment right after Geek Bits called Things That Are Older Than Ben. And then we'll
A really long segment.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. We'll limit it to five things.
Of course, I mean, even if we limit it to stuff that's, younger than the rest of us, but older than Ben. That still is just so long.
Mm-hmm. Oh, dear.
What did I get myself into last week? Mentioning.
Okay, so I think we have time for another news story. Lindsay.
Okay, so let me see which one I was going to do first. The sarcastic tweets. So apparently there is an algorithm that's been put together that recognizes sarcastic tweets. And I just thought that
tweets was... Tweets as in Twitter.
Twitter tweets.
Messages. Okay.
Yeah. No way.
Exactly. A team from the Hebrew University in Israel developed this algorithm. And it identifies sarcastic sentences by using a machine learning technique where a small number of sarcastic sentences act as seeds for the software to learn and recognize more. And so it's actually been highly accurate when they've been testing it. And they're going to do a demo of it next week in Washington, D.C. So
it detects sarcastic tweets?
Yes.
It detects sarcastic tweets?
It detects sarcasm. So an algorithm that can detect sarcasm, yeah. I think, is pretty impressive.
I think useful.
I think I need a... See, I was going for that before, but I couldn't think of something that sarcastic. I think I need a better algorithm for detecting sarcastic tweets. Is there any way to interface this with the human brain?
Yeah. They said that it's not perfect, but their whole thing is, well, humans aren't perfect at it either, so.
That's true.
Yes.
Okay. So now we're coming to the end. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, and we thank the Puppet Master for its use. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a weekly hour-long radio quiz. Each week on the radio, you can test your knowledge against some of the best and brightest in the news and entertainment world while figuring out what's real news and what's made up. On the web, you can play along, too. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, today at noon on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. And now, I give you Al with the USB of the week.
Hello, everyone. This is Al Lacow again with GeekSpeak's crazy USB device of the week. So, I want to remind people that these devices I mention are bizarre. They are the strange and unusual things that engineers design to use the USB port on your computer. Well, this one certainly belongs in the list. It's a USB shoe warmer slash dryer. Personally, I just don't get why you would want to hook your wet shoes to a computer, but somebody thought this was a good idea. Basically, it's one USB cable that splits into two, and then each cable is connected to what looks like a dog. Yes, a dog. And it has holes in it. So what you do is you plug the USB cable into your computer and then stick these dogs into your shoes. Then presumably they heat up and dry out your shoes. My guess is that they probably wouldn't work on sandals. There's no word on how hot they get or how long it takes, but then the entire product page is in Japanese. So maybe that info is in there. Just if you don't believe me, the link is going to be up on geekspeak.org after the show. So I'll see you next time.
Thank you, Al. And thank you, Ben and Lindsay, for joining us on the show as well.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. Once again, thank you for listening to GeekSpeak. Coming up next is Car Talk.